Hello. This first lecture covers mostly administrative issues, how the course is going to run. The first line says the definitive source of course information is the website. So you're here at the website, and if you click on announcements, that will keep you up to date with what's going on in the class. So in theory, if you didn't go to any lectures, you wouldn't be missing things because we'll be doing the lectures online. In fact, my hope, as I'll talk about later, is to break the class into smaller groups and meet with people in smaller groups rather than have the entire semester consist of lectures. Okay, so today what I'm going to talk about is my background, what the course objectives are, what the grading policy is, and other administrative issues. Okay, my background is I have a PhD in economics from MIT. My first job after my PhD was with the Federal Reserve Board here in Washington, D.C. as an economist. Spent time doing both macroeconomics and some regulatory policy issues at the Fed. Then I was with Freddie Mac, which is the Federal Home Loan Mortgage Corporation. It's based in Virginia, and it buys mortgages that are originated by lenders and then either holds them or resells them. In 1994, I quit Freddie Mac and started one of the very first commercial websites. This was a time when the World Wide Web was just getting started. There were only about 1,000 websites when I started. It's a site called homefair.com. It still exists. But I sold it in 1999, which, if you know anything about the history of the internet and markets, was a very good time to sell because there was a stock market bubble in internet stocks at the time, and one of the companies that had issued a lot of stock bought Homefair, and the way I describe it is they paid for it in a combination of cash and stock, and the cash retained its value, meaning that the stock did not retain its value. After that, I spent several years teaching, mostly at high school, but last year I taught this course at George Mason. It was my first year teaching here, and there were a lot of things that I tried experimentally and a lot of things that were new since I had not been on a college campus in over 20 years. It felt a bit like Rip Van Winkle, seeing sort of a new breed of students and new types of technology, and so I'm It was kind of a learning experience for me last year. I learned some things that worked well for the most part and a couple of things that didn't work well. And so I'm going to ditch the things that didn't work well and stick with the things that worked well. I've gone into teaching basically because I like teaching. I've had been fortunate to have some great teachers. I value learning and I enjoy getting in touch with young people, and I enjoy teaching, and I enjoy having young people learn. In addition to teaching, I've written a couple of books. One is called Under the Radar, and that book is about my experience starting a business, and it's also profiles about 25 other people who were starting businesses around that time, all internet-related businesses. That book sort of summarizes my business experience. And then the other book, which is I list as a textbook for this course, is Learning Economics, and it's really a series of essays on economic topics. I also maintain a weblog or blog called EconLog, and you're welcome to look at that. The material is accessible to students, although it's more accessible probably to economics majors, people with more interest in economics. Finally, I've been writing quite a few essays. I publish online about 1 to 2 essays a week, and you're welcome to examine those. Those are essays. Some of those became parts of the book, and some other essays are also assigned in the course. Okay, let's move on to course objectives. One objective is that this will improve your understanding of the economy. That is, you'll come out with a better idea of what a business does. It's not a rich uncle that employs people to be nice to them. We'll talk about, in economic terms, what a business does. And this is based also in part on my experience If you go back to my background, most of my experience has been in business as opposed to being in academics. And that gives me a slightly different perspective than the typical economics professor about what a business, how a business works. For example, in economics, we talk about a business as trying to maximize its profits. And in economics textbooks, that's always represented as some kind of mathematical project, solving some mathematical optimization problem. When I was in business, I never saw one of those optimization problems. We never had that much information. It was a lot of guesswork, trial and error, sort of based on very imperfect knowledge. And so I bring some of that perspective, and that actually has shaped my view of how the economy works. I know I don't like to think of it in the optimization framework that many academic economists do. But in any case, what a business does is something that is useful to understand when you come out of this course, because as hard for some of you to believe now, a lot of you are going to end up in a business. In fact, a surprising number of you are going to end up starting a business because the trends in the economy are toward more and more people spending more and more time self-employed. So understanding what a business does, even if you have had no thought of ever being a business major or an economics major, some years down the line, it will be helpful. The next thing that of course, objective is to understand policy intentions versus consequences. This is about, the course is called Economics for the Citizen. And so as a citizen, when you vote, you ought to vote with some knowledge of how economics affects the way policy works out. And very often, what economists find is that the intentions of a policy are not the same as the consequences. So a classic example, I'm sure I'll refer to it several times, would be something like requiring Walmart to give health benefits to employees. The intention of that is to make employees better off. There's a very good chance that such a policy would make employees worse off. And I'll walk through that analysis, I'm sure, at least once or twice in the course of this course, maybe even today. The next issue is just to understand how economists think, because it's an interesting thought process, and it's a very systematic way of looking at how people behave. It's not just saying, here's good and here's evil. It's more of looking at systematically what are the consequences of how people interact with one another in the marketplace without trying to label somebody as good because they do one thing or evil because they do another. We instead look at the whole system and how the system operates. So that's the first major objective, is improving understanding of the economy, what a business does, policy intention versus the consequences, and how economists think. The second big course objective is communicating information analysis. And what that means is developing communication skills, particularly being able to read and to write. So be able to read an analytical piece, be able to summarize it and criticize it intelligently, and put that summary and criticism in writing. So think of this as a course where you're going to have to do reading and writing. Think of it being, in that sense, like a history course or a government course, and that you'll be graded in part on how well you do that communication, how well you show that you understand the material that you read or the material that you might hear in the lecture, and how well you communicate it to others. And so regardless of whether you have anything to do with the substance of economics in the future, chances are it's going to be important for you to be able to communicate in whatever job you have, and developing that skill is part of this course. Okay, now let me talk a little bit about the substance, about what economics is about. And I'm going to start by saying at a very high level, you can think of there being two paradigms or two approaches to economics. The approach that's in traditional textbooks, and the approach that you would get if you were taking the traditional course sequence of, first year economics, intermediate economics, and then going on, that first approach I call optimization and equilibrium. The assumption is that individuals optimize, that is, you try to get the best you can in terms of a job, you try to get the best job you can, you try to get buy the best car you can, try to get the best housing you can. So as a consumer, you optimize, and that businesses try to optimize, they try to get the most profits. So there's the main behavioral assumption is optimization. And there's also a lot of emphasis on the term equilibrium. That is, an equilibrium sounds to me like a resting place. So you say if consumers are optimizing and businesses are optimizing, what sort of resting place does that result in? Where do prices come out? Where do quantity, supply, and demand come out? How efficient is this equilibrium? And in economics, we'll often talk about going from one equilibrium to another. Classic example being, let's say, before trade and after trade. So we have two countries that, let's say, were not allowed to trade, or the transportation costs were too high for trade, and all of a sudden trading opportunities open up. So that will move from one equilibrium, the equilibrium before trade, to the new equilibrium when trading is allowed. And we've seen an example of that with what you hear about outsourcing. That is, 15 years ago, there was no way that computer programming or telephone support could have been done in India for an American company. Now it can be done. So you move from one equilibrium, an equilibrium where it's impossible to have certain tasks be done in India, to a new equilibrium where it is now possible for those tasks to be done in India. And we can ask, what are the characteristics of this equilibrium? In what sense is it more efficient or not more efficient? In what sense are people better off or not better off? And that's the kind of traditional economic focus. And we'll talk about that particularly when we talk about the subject of trade. But this course is mostly going to emphasize the second paradigm, in which we talk about economics, the economy, as a system for learning. It is, over time, the economy is a learning system. It adds new and more efficient ways of producing things, and it discards old and inefficient ways of producing things. And we'll talk about the mechanisms by which it does that. And I think that's a more interesting approach, and I think it's a more realistic approach. Again, going back to my experience in business, we were never in an equilibrium. We were never at a resting place. We really were not sure that we were optimizing. We were doing the best we could, we thought, but we weren't solving a mathematical optimization problem. But we were always learning. There was always trying new things and discarding what didn't work and trying to hold on to what worked, trying to copy what worked well somewhere else. So this learning aspect seemed to me a very important part of real business world and the real economy. Okay, so I think I've talked enough about the academic versus business entrepreneur perspective, that as a business and entrepreneur, there's less information and more need to learn, was sort of my experience as a business entrepreneur, than what I saw in academics, where you sort of assume that all the information is just sitting out there. There's no discussion of learning in a lot of the academic literature. Another thing that I'm going to be doing about this course that's different from a traditional introductory course is that we're going to use policy issues to organize the course rather than concepts. So rather than say, all right, we're going to teach supply and demand this week, and we're going to teach opportunity cost this week, instead we're going to start from policy issues and then bring in concepts to help understand those policy issues. So I draw an analogy of teaching chemistry. In high school, I had a chemistry teacher who tried to teach chemistry, and actually worked very well by teaching it from the historical focus. That is, he started from the way chemists thought in the 1700s, and then he added new discoveries along the way, and he sort of taught the history of chemistry, and you could teach economics the same way, history of economic thought. But that's a difficult way to do it, and that's not the approach here. And then there's another approach would be to teach using concepts. So if you're teaching chemistry in terms of concepts, you might talk about molar mass, and then you might talk about acids and, or you might talk about equations, you know, balancing equations, and you might talk about acids and bases, and then you might talk about different types of bonding. And you could bring in all these concepts. Another approach teaching chemistry would be to take a subject like batteries. Batteries are a very important part of the economy nowadays because people want portable power. They want a portable power for their computers or for their cell phones or for their cars. And so batteries is just a very interesting topic, and it brings up all the issues of chemistry, of chemical reactions, of electrons, of acids and bases, and so on. And you could actually teach a chemistry course by saying, all right, how could we go about designing batteries or comparing battery design? And so if you think of that approach to teaching chemistry, well, my approach to teaching economics is sort of like that. We say, well, what about Social Security, some of these other issues? Okay, so how do I plan to go about teaching the course? The first thing exercise we'll do is we'll go through planning a business. And in order to do that, I'll have to bring in some basic concepts like capital, interest rates, renting versus buying, and some basic economic concepts like that, factors of production. And so we'll start out with that exercise of planning a business. And that, I think, gives you sort of, you know, puts you right in the middle of the economy rather than starting from the academic perspective of, you know, 1,000 feet up. You're right in the middle of the economy if you're trying to think about planning a business. After that, then we will take the more standard academic approach of looking at the economy from the outside as if we were evaluating it or trying to make policies about it. And the issues that we're going to discuss, there are going to be six of them. They're going to be economic growth, international trade, energy, social security, healthcare, and education. And last year I taught this course during the election year, and I knew that the last five issues, trade, energy, social security, healthcare, and education, would all come up during the election, and they did. This is not an election year, so we don't have that going for us, but those issues still come up. Next, I'd like to talk a little about my teaching philosophy. My goal is to teach for long-term memory. I tell a story that I've only taken one music course in my life, and that was just about 30 years ago. But a couple years ago, I was walking through the living room, and a Simpsons episode was on, and I heard a few bars of Schubert's Unfinished Symphony, and I remembered it from my music course. And I thought, that's pretty amazing. The music professor took me, who had no aptitude or interest in music, and got me to remember something that I, you know, wouldn't have remembered, and I remembered it 30 years later. And so that's kind of my hope here, is that you will at least pick up a few things that stick with you for a long period of time. Second element of teaching philosophy, and this I didn't execute at all last year, but I hope to do this year, is get to know some students. One of my favorite professors died last year, and I went to a memorial service for him. And it was really clear at that memorial service that the key to his teaching wasn't anything he did at the blackboard. In fact, he rarely went to the blackboard. And it wasn't even so much any special way of presenting economics, but he really got to know students. And I don't think anyone can imitate his particular style and approach. And it, you know, he taught in a different context, different, you know, different time, different place. But I do want to at least give the opportunity to get to know some students, which is why I want to try to break this into somewhat smaller groups. And finally, probably the most important thing about teaching philosophy is that student engagement matters. I can't force economics down anyone's throat. Students who are engaged and who are active and who want to learn will learn, and students who want to avoid learning will avoid learning. I'm not going to be able to stop a student from not learning. I'll do my best to provide you the opportunity to learn, but ultimately it's student engagement that matters. When I was in business, I developed a very refined job interview technique, and it's what I call a passive-aggressive approach. A job candidate would walk in. I would spend between 30 seconds and a minute describing the job and, what my department did, and then I would say, "Well, what questions do you have?" And if the student asked, I'm sorry, if the job candidate asked really good questions, and the types of questions that were good questions would be, what do I have to do to be successful? What is your department's responsibilities? What are your responsibilities? What would be my responsibilities on the job? If the person asked really good questions and showed that they could really be engaged with the job, then they had an excellent chance of being hired. If the only questions they could come up with were, what are the benefits, then that wasn't then I was not inclined to hire them. And if they just said, "I have no questions," then I definitely was not inclined to hire them. So you I because when you go to work in a business, unless it's something really routine where you're just being trained to be almost like a robot, you have to use your brain. You're going to have to ask questions. You're going to have to learn how to do the job, and you're going to have to be curious and involved and motivated. And if people aren't curious and aren't motivated, you really can't get them to work effectively. And I feel the same way as a professor. It's your curiosity and your motivation that's going to ultimately determine how much you learn in the class. Okay, next, an administrative topic that I'm sure will be interest to everyone, grading policy. There will be no tests or quizzes. Last year I had one final exam. I thought that was one of the things that didn't work. It was one of those silly Scantron multiple guess type of final exams. I thought it had no educational value, so I'm not going to have that. If there's some requirement here that I report something as a final exam grade, I'll probably take one of the larger assignments and call that the final exam grade. 50% of the grade is writing analytical papers on two books, and I have a list of the books. I choose the books. I think that's part of the professor's job. There's a long list. You get a lot of choices. I don't think anyone had difficulty finding a book from the list. And so you'll do two papers, and if one of them has to be called the final, I'll have the second one be the final. There will be 10 other assignments. Almost all of them handed in. One of them will be an oral assignment, so nothing's handed in, but the rest will be handed in, and each of those is worth 5 points. So one oral presentation, three problem sets, and six unit highlights. The oral presentation and the three problem sets you'll do as a group. I think you'll be grateful to be doing the problem sets as a group because they're kind of long, and for some of you they may be a bit difficult since they involve some basic algebra. And the oral presentation is it's just generically a group project because it's this business of trying to plan a business, and that's something that's better brainstormed as a group than done as an individual. The other six assignments are individual assignments, as are the analytical papers on the two books. So the other six, they're called unit highlights, and I'll talk more about what I mean by a unit highlight, but think of it as you were writing a one or two paragraphs to someone that you know who has not had economics, and you're trying to explain what you learned in that particular unit. Explain some highlight that you learned. Not everything you might have learned, certainly not everything that was covered, but some important point from a unit. Write as if you were explaining to a friend who doesn't know economics. And again, if you want more details and due dates, the whole list of assignments is on the web. You can click on the link. Some key points about handing in assignments. First, do not use email. Hand in hard copy. A couple of reasons for that. One is it's easier for me to grade. It's easier for me to track. There's none of this. There's no confusion about whether you sent it or didn't send it. If you hand in hard copy, it's there. And also, quite honestly, last year the email system wasn't reliable. Maybe I didn't understand what was going on, but people would send me stuff and it never got there. So I only rely on hard copy for handing in assignments. I will allow one emergency late assignment per semester. That is, if you hand in one assignment late, I'll grade it no problem. If you try to hand in a second assignment late, I will not grade it. So it's up to you to decide what an emergency is for that emergency. But I think of it as a way of allowing you to be late one time on an emergency basis. But in general, you shouldn't be late. Also note that quality of writing will count for about a third of your grade. I do not want instant message type writing. I don't want informal writing. I don't want slang and adolescent expressions. I want adult, business caliber, government caliber writing. And that writing again will count for one third of your grade. I'd say based on last year, I would probably the vast majority of you, at least 90% of you, ought to submit some of your writing to a writing center and get help with it. I think that again, it's one of the skills that I want to see improved in this course is writing skills. And if going to a writing center will help, then I think that's a way to go. Other points. I'm going to try to break people into groups, as I mentioned. I'll discuss that more as the in next month. Office hours will generally be before class. I'll come in about 45 minutes before class, and there's an office on the third floor. We'll have my name on it. You can ask the secretary where that is. And then there's an announcements page that's absolutely critical for keeping up with the course, especially if I'm not going to make you come to class every single time for lectures. The way to keep up will be go to the announcements page. I will expect that you have read every announcement. So if you don't get in the habit of going to the announcements page, then that's as bad or worse as skipping class all the time. That's sort of the equivalent. Okay, now I'm gonna, that's everything I have to say on administrative issues. I thought I would talk for a few minutes about economics itself. I want to explain why economics has to be learned, why you have to study economics, why you don't already know economics. In fact, what you think you know is what I call folk economics. It tends to be a set of instincts that you acquired that people acquired as hunter-gatherers, you know, in evolutionary terms. Back in the hunter-gatherer days, a lot of our instincts developed to solve the problems of, you know, working in a tribe and hunting for animals on the savanna. And that's sort of, you know, where our brains developed. And so if you just follow your instinct, you'll have sort of this hunter-gatherer, or what I call folk economics, way of thinking, which does not apply in today's modern world. So here are some differences comparing the hunter-gatherer society versus the modern society. The hunter-gatherer society, strangers are threats. If you see somebody who's not from your tribe, there's a big chance that that person is going to steal from you or maybe try to kill you. In modern society, we depend on strangers. Everything you buy in the store got to that store because of the work of thousands and thousands of people who you do not know. So we depend on strangers in modern society. So an example of the primitive misconception that people have is that people say, well, international trade helps them. It helps the Chinese, or it helps India, or it helps Pakistan, but it does not help us. Or immigration helps the Mexicans, it does not help us. That's a misconception that goes back to the view of strangers as threats. If we understand through economics how we depend on strangers, then we'll understand how international trade helps all of us. In hunter-gatherer society, goods are taken or shared. In modern society, they're produced or traded. So a primitive misconception that results is people think of producers as thieves. People look at Walmart as evil. They look at Microsoft as evil because the assumption, because you tend to think, take the goods for granted. You take it for granted that there's going to be software, that there's going to be cheap shirts, and so on. And so it seems like the only thing that big companies can do, if you've got this hunter-gatherer folk economics way of thinking, is, well, they must take more than anybody else. That's what a business does. It takes more. But in fact, goods are produced and traded. And when we think about that, we get away from this view that producers are thieves. In a hunter-gatherer society, one's gain is another's loss. There's a term called zero sum for that. That is, if you add up somebody's gain and somebody else's loss, it adds to zero. Modern society, there are tremendous gains from trade and growth that are mutual gains. It's not that one person gains and another person loses. It's that everybody gains. So primitive misconception is that the only thing that affects how well off people are is redistribution, that only redistribution affects wealth. In fact, very little redistribution has accomplished very little in terms of changing wealth. It's actually growth that has produced wealth. So that's another example of the folk economics that we're going to try to get over. Brian Kaplan, who is on the faculty at George Mason, has done some comparison of economist beliefs and non-economist beliefs. That is, you take a set of survey questions about some policy issues, and you compare the answers that economists give and that non-economists give. And he found some systematic differences between people in those beliefs. In particular, four non-economic biases: an anti-market bias, which is a belief that high prices are caused by greed. You'll find that economists look at fundamental forces. So something like the high price of gasoline, it's not all of a sudden because all of a sudden gas stations have gotten greedy. It's that the growth of demand from countries like China has exceeded the increase in supply of oil among oil suppliers, and that pushes up prices. So it's not that all of a sudden somebody out there became greedier. Anti-foreign bias. People seem to support free trade, but that support stops at the water's edge. There's no question, no one ever says, oh, I won't buy products made in Virginia or in New York or in Maryland. But there are people who will say, oh, I would never buy something made in France or Pakistan. So there's an anti-foreign bias that, again, that economists don't have, at least in their way of thinking about economic problems. A pessimistic bias. So you see this particularly in the press, constantly stories about how the middle class can't make it, all these doomsday economic scenarios. This is going to crash. This bubble's going to pop. People are going to be worse off. And economists tend to look at fundamental long-term trends and be less pessimistic. The final bias that Brian found was make work bias. People seem to be afraid that we're going to run out of work, that anything that subtracts jobs is a threat. So higher productivity, well, that must be a threat. Foreign suppliers, that's a threat. Economists don't think of jobs as being scarce ever. We think of the scarce resources as being the things that you would want to consume rather than things you would want to avoid. And work is something that you fundamentally would want to avoid. Okay, let me give my example then of Walmart and health insurance. Will Walmart's workers be better off if we pass a law forcing Walmart to give generous health insurance to their employees? So all of your primitive misconceptions are, of course, yeah, they'll be better off, right? They need health insurance. Walmart's a big, rich company. They can afford it, so on. Economics would say, wait a minute. Walmart hires very low skilled workers. And Walmart, like any other company, pays people what they're worth. They give them compensation that's based on how productive they are. So, and if you're hiring people with low skills, they're not going to be terribly productive. You're not going to be able to pay them huge salaries. So, if Walmart is paying people what they're worth overall, that, and you say, okay, now you have to give them more health insurance, what they'll have to do is cut their wages. That is, people will have less, Walmart's workers will have less money to take home, and they'll be forced to take more of their income as health insurance. So a law that forces Walmart to pay more, to provide more health insurance to their employees, is really an infringement on the worker. It's saying the worker, no, you can't have, you can't take most of your income from Walmart as take-home pay. You're going to have to take a lot of it in the form of health insurance because we, as legislators, have decided that health insurance is more important for you than anything you mu else you might buy if you had more take-home pay. So that's an example of how economists think through consequences rather than intentions. Because clearly the intention of a legislator passing that law would be that Walmart wouldn't cut take-home pay and would just throw in more health insurance just out of the generosity of its heart. But in fact, if a relatively unskilled worker is only producing, let's say, $20,000 worth of, or $25,000 worth of work a year, they're not going to get a $25,000 salary plus $5,000 worth of health insurance. They're more likely to get a $23,000 salary and $2,000 worth of health insurance. And if you try to push on that too hard, Walmart will either cut their take-home pay, or if it gets too extreme, actually not be able to hire those unskilled workers, and will have to substitute with some, get by with something else, use machines, use some other way of getting the job done, and would actually have to fire people. So anyway, that's an example of sort of economic thinking versus just sort of gut level emotional thinking. Okay, things to remember, the main things to remember from this lecture are, first of all, that the website is the hub of the course. It's the definitive source of information. You want to check the assignment, the announcements page at least a couple of times a week to see what's going on. Second key point, your grade depends on handing the assignments. Timeliness is vital. Remember, you can only turn in an assignment late if it's an emergency, and you can only have one emergency per semester. Remember that a key skill is digesting information. You're going to have to show that you understood something. You're not. It isn't. This isn't a BS course. It isn't how well you make up information. It isn't how well you express your opinion. It's how well you take information, analyze it, and sure, criticize it all you want, or support it, or whatever you want. In that sense, you can put your opinion in there, but you have to show that you understand, and you have to express yourself clearly. You might want to remember how this course differs from standard introductory economics. So if you're ever to take an introductory economics course, or find someone taking an introductory economics course, a standard course, you would see all sorts of exercises and diagrams that you're not going to see in this course, so don't be shocked about that. And maybe try to remember that some of the mistakes of folk economics. We're going to dwell on those a lot in this course. Again, we're trying, as a citizen, trying to get you to, instead of being a hunter-gatherer in the way you think about economics, actually have some understanding of how the modern economy works. Okay, so that's the first lecture. Thanks.